Hello and welcome. You're tuned into the best in True Crime Talk Radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. And for those of you that are subscribers to Darkness Radio, you very rarely get to hear a True Crime Tuesday episode, but this is one that we felt that kind of transcended the normal vein. And because of the guests that we have on, I wanted to make sure that we have a bigger platform so that not only our True Crime Tuesday subscribers and all of you on Stitcher Premium can hear this interview, but all of you across all of the different platforms will get a chance to hear this, because I think it's a really important story. You know, Tim, during this quarantine, a lot of us have spent time watching many different docuseries and strange, bizarre antics of what's considered TV these days.
Yeah.
And I stumbled down the rabbit hole of a really strange story. I remember hearing this because I was a fan of the show Smallville. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing that Chloe Sullivan from Smallville was being arrested on sex trafficking and part of a cult. And I remember, this is insane. What is this? And I started reading about it back then and kind of discarded it, just not sure what the process of this, and thought I'd wait and see it play out. And about a week ago, I came across some documentaries and started pursuing this storyline. And it was unbelievable, to say the least. And the reason I guess it resonated so much with me was twofold. One, an interesting scenario in my own life that began to unfold years ago that I saw tying into this. And secondly, our guest who's joining us today, as the father of four very strong, powerful women in my life that I love to no end, I saw this woman's story play out, and it was heartbreaking from every aspect to watch how this happened. And When you hear the word cult, you automatically begin thinking zany people wearing crazy clothes and doing stupid things. And obviously these are the broken people of society, the dumb, the dim-witted, the easily led. And as I watched and started reading more and more about cults, I realized that's not who they go after at all. Mm-hmm. That's not what's a part of their storyline. As a matter of fact, the more affluent and influential and intelligent you are, the better it is to incorporate you, because you lend legitimacy
right
to their cause.
Right.
And I watched this documentary about Nexium. And I'm not going to mention the name of this documentary, because it was just the key that opened the lock to the much what I consider a better docuseries, which is what our guest is here about. And we're going to talk about that in a second. But I thought, how can people fall for something so stupid? And I watched this other docuseries. And the first episode, I left the episode crossing my arms and shaking my head. And I thought to myself, oh, shit, this would have been me. I'd have fallen down this rabbit hole so easily, because what we all want is to be better. We want to find a way to make our lives better and make our worlds better. And, you know, I've worked in the motivational speaker field for years. Mm-hmm. And I worked with Og Mandino and Lou Holtz and Tony Robbins and Fran Tarkenton and just so many of these great speakers. And I ended up leaving this company, which is very reputable and a very good company, Peak Performers Network, who just brought in speakers. But you learned, I wanted to evolve. I wanted to be better than who I was. And I saw the potential of the world around me and wondered why other people could not come in to be a part of that as well. And with that said, I started working with a local motivational speaker, and watching these docuseries triggered an emotional response in me and a mental response, because working with this man, who I won't name because I'm not going to give him that power, I watched how he took people apart, and especially women, and he almost liked to rub it in my nose, right, and show me how powerful he was. But I liked his message. I liked where he was going when he was on stage. Who he portrayed in those moments was powerful to me.
Okay.
And he stuttered incessantly when he was off stage. He was an insecure guy. I could relate to that. I do a radio show. I do a TV show. But internally, I'm very insecure and I'm very shy. I can go talk to tens of thousands of people, but you get me one-on-one and I get very uncomfortable. So I could relate to this guy. He was human. He was fallible. And it was interesting because he would, and I'm not mocking, but this is a conversation. He'd be, Dave, today we're going to go out and try to inspire people. And you'd hear him talk like that. And then I think, how is this going to inspire? And he would go up on stage and it was like magic because the stutter went away. The security and self-satisfaction of trying to help others took over and the stutter was gone. And that blew me away until I started to see behind the veneer. And I noticed that when he started talking about cruel moments of how he was milking, he was milking women, socialite women in the Twin Cities areas for money. And he was living a pretty high lifestyle. And I noticed the only time his stuttering stopped besides on stage is when he talked about the women and how he was taking from them. And when I would question him, he'd literally tap me on the forehead and say, you need to change your thinking. You're looking at this wrong. You're allowing the outside world to influence what you perceive, and you have to see this. And this term kept coming up over and over, how he needed to break me of my bad habits, of my bad thoughts, and bring me into this new paradigm. And when we finally split ways, when I finally had enough, I remember looking at him and I said, you keep saying you need to break me. And isn't it interesting? The only thing you need to break is something that isn't broken. And to me, it makes it sound like you're trying to do to me what you're doing to so many other people, which is why I'm walking away right now. And although it's nowhere in comparison to what our guest went through, I could see how easily you can get pulled into something that seems to have a greater call. You can even overlook some of what would be considered bad protocol, because the overall arc of the story is making a good change. And that's what Keith Raniere promised to his followers. And he created this program of trying to better people. And in the first documentary, they almost show him in a glossier light. And you start to see the fallibility as who he is, and the alien underneath the skin starts to appear. But throughout, you see the story of this girl who becomes absorbed into this cult and sees the same thing I saw in working with the speaker I worked with. I saw an opportunity to make the world a better place and help. And, it's hard because when you have a guest like this on, there's so many names that are ascribed to them, right? Victims and cult members, or, I don't even want to throw those out there because our guest is so much more than the titles that have been assessed to her. And I think it does her a disservice because she isn't that. She's human. She's fallible. She made mistakes. But what she has done since realizing these mistakes is where the story lies. Mm-hmm. And the documentary I'm talking about, again, you subscribe to Stars. If you haven't, this is the perfect reason to do it. Seduced: Inside the Nexium Cult is the name of the docuseries. And it immediately goes for the throat of this story. It peels back much of the shiny veneer of other documentaries or programs that are out there, and it goes right to showing this man for what he was and who he was immediately, which I respected. And took away the sympathy factor for maybe this guy was misguided and started to fall into the wrong loop. You realize from the beginning, this guy is just not right. And the person that is the focus of this documentary, and she's behind it as a producer and executive producer, is India Oxenberg. And India comes from actual royalty and comes from TV royalty and has cut her own way in the world. And she's here with us to talk about her story. And India, thank you so much for being with us today and opening up about this and speaking a little bit more in depth today.
By the way, your story just gave me chills. I was worried while you were talking because it froze on Skype, and I was like, oh no, I wanted to hear the end of the story. So I'm glad that it's working now. Can you hear me all right?
I can. Thank you for hanging in with us on this. Yeah, this can always be dodgy, but I'm glad that we're still in this. India, talk to me, if you would, about your life growing up. I want to know about you as the person, not just the focal point of this documentary and about the things that unraveled. Tell me about your life and growing up. What was it like?
Thank you for saying all those kind things about me. I think it's so easy to kind of just put somebody in a in a box of, you know, a headline rather than remembering that there's a person behind this story. And I did put myself out there pretty rawly. And that was my promise to the docuseries, that that was what I wanted to do. And that was my way of getting through it. But prior to all of this craziness, I mean, I grew up here in Southern California with my mother, and I have a big extended family that are all around. And so I felt always very loved and cared for, and also inspired by the people I grew up with. Both of my mom and my stepdad are in the entertainment industry. And so that was kind of, you know, second nature for me. And I always watched it from the side, and I enjoyed production and work and being on set. And I actually told my mom that my preferred job would be craft service when I was little, because I loved just the spread, and I'm also huge in feeding people and food and all of that. So I always gravitated towards craft service, not only because of the treats that were there, but also because that's part of my nature. And I think growing up in Southern California, in a family that was kind of saturated by that world, it gave me a feeling of, I know this, but that's not for me. And I didn't know what that was. I thought maybe this is just me trying to figure out what my path is, but I really distanced myself from it for a while. And I went looking for other things. And by the time, you know, I was 19 years old, I had just spent a year in Boston in university, and I was trying to carve a path for myself. Little did I know that I was like every other teenager in 2009, which was a huge shift politically and economically. And there was a lot of, kind of similar to what we're dealing with now, a lot of people looking for jobs, looking for work, and college didn't necessarily promise that. So I was worried, and I actually ended up going back to California and pursuing production and a career in catering. And so that was kind of where I thought I was going to go. And I hit the normal kind of growing pains of starting a new business, and I felt really scared and kind of lost in that. And it wasn't until someone, a close friend of my mom and I actually, who we both trusted, she was that friend that kind of tells you to do everything or go to this restaurant, see this movie, but she was the self-help version of that. And so we were like, okay, we'll go to this intro presentation that you're speaking so highly of. And that intro ended up being the ESP intro presentation, which was kind of the consumer front of Nexium. And it was their self-help program that they were selling. And for some reason, what they said in the pitch was exactly what I felt like I was looking for. And I was just hooked from that point on. And I remember turning to my mom and saying, this is for me. I really want to do this, like wholeheartedly. And I was kind of in this, you know, 19-year-old phase of not knowing what the heck I was going to do. I didn't want to make any decisions. And the fact that I was so certain about this really struck my mom. And she turned to me and she was like, okay, just kind of happy that I had made a decision on something. And so I turned to her and I said, you know, I really want to do this with you. Like, I want to improve our relationship. Not that we had a bad one, but we had, you know, the normal mother-daughter stuff that every teenage girl goes through. And I wanted to get closer with her. And that was kind of the beginning of my journey that lasted 7 years in most of my 20s in Nexium. And so prior to that, yes, I had a whole life, but I was also really young and I didn't have a ton of experience in the world. And so what I thought I was getting out of Nexium and the way that they pitched it to me was like a practical MBA, and that I would be able to take their tools and translate them to whatever business I was going to do. And I thought, okay, great. I'm dyslexic. I didn't do very well in traditional education. I struggle in class and keeping up with the reading demands. And so I always felt very insecure, like, oh, maybe college isn't for me, but maybe a mentorship or a apprenticeship is more my style. So right. I really looked at it like that.
I watched all the different iterations, as I said, and what struck me was your mom. I know Catherine Oxenberg said, she kind of turned to you and she's like, this isn't, what? This sounds crazy, but okay, if you're into it and this is going to give us 5 days of working together on bettering things, she was all for it. And it's, you know, I like that you point out you were 19. This was a different turning point for you. To your mom, it can look different because, again, she came at it from a perspective of someone older who'd been in the business for a long time, had seen many things, and had already found her path. And, you know, it's even in introducing today, talking to you, you're not Catherine Oxenberg's daughter to me. You're India. You have your story to tell. And, you know, it's impossible to not tell part of the story without explaining who your mom is and where she fits into all of this.
And but, I think it's actually really relevant because, mm-hmm. as you said before, we didn't realize that we were more or less targeted for a specific demographic that they were looking for. And when you're you don't think about yourself like that. So, mm-hmm. I mean, I wasn't walking into that room thinking, oh, me and Catherine Oxenberg are going to sit here and watch this presentation. I'm like, me and my mom, and we're going to go home and make dinner. But it was just, it was so slick the way that they did it. And it was so unassuming. I mean, it just wasn't obvious to us. And yes, my mom was definitely looking at it from a different perspective. One, she's a seeker. So she's been in this world for a long time. She was very aware of many different programs. And we had done things together, and she had done things with my stepdad throughout their marriage. And they were familiar with personal growth. They enjoyed it, but it wasn't that she needed it in the same, like she didn't have the same desire or vacant hole that I felt like I needed to fill that my mother did. She's a mother of daughters. She has a career herself. And so we were at very different stages. And I think that's one of the things that I wanted to make really clear in the docuseries is that people who know how to manipulate and prey on people know their vulnerabilities. And they know them before you do, almost. Right.
And what they don't know, they find ways to get from you so that they can use it over you.
And that was one of the things that NXIVM was great at. And I hate giving them a lot of credit, but I mean, if it's one thing, it's extorting and extracting information from people so that they can use it for their benefit. And they trained the coaches to even do that. So I like to look at it now as a predatory system rather than just one predator. Because you can see the similarities. I mean, Keith is the main problem. He is the predator in the situation.
Apex predator,
exactly. But what he was able to do and what other people in power, unfortunately, we've seen in the Harvey Weinsteins and the Jeffrey Epsteins is create a system in which they don't even have to really lift a finger when it comes to doing the dirty work. They have other people do it for them. And so how are you supposed to know that if you're someone who just looks at the world normally? You don't think like that. You don't think, how can I set something up so that I can actually con people? But those exist.
Well, and you're also looking at NXIVM as a step to be better. And you're hearing from speakers and leaders saying, the world can be better. We can be better. Here's what we can do. Let's break old paradigms. Let's shift our thinking. Let's stop. And listen, like I said, parts of it spoke to me. I hate the victimization of the world. Everybody's a victim of something. Everybody, sometimes we hide behind that shield and it empowers us, but deflowers us at the same time. Yeah. It allows us not to grow because we're so sheltered behind the shield of, oh, pity me. And I like the fact that we have to relinquish the victimization and we have to let ourselves exceed beyond those expectations that have either been set before us by people in our past or even our own limitations. That's why I said
it's supposed to be that. I mean, or at least that's what the sales pitch was.
Sure.
And to me, like the idea of personal responsibility was great. I was like, I don't want to be a little weakling. Like I want to be strong. I want to be a potent professional woman in the world. And so all of those things really spoke to me and they were exactly what I was looking for. And that was a vulnerability of mine. I mean, if I would have known that that was something that I felt like I needed to fill, maybe I would have been able to see it differently, but I didn't. And I was young. And I think a lot of people can relate to that, you know, looking for something bigger than themselves.
Well, and especially when you find that key trigger, right? I mean, that's why so many activists are young people, because they want a better world than what their parents have had or what their parents are building. And by coming together, that's how we get over this hump. And one of the downtrodden aspects of humanity for a long time has been women. You're great to cook for us, clean for us, and do our bidding, but let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Right.
And here was an opportunity being led by a very powerful woman, right? I mean, Keith Raniere had his underlings, but he certainly had a very powerful associate that was also instrumental in ushering in the women to, mm-hmm. to show that we are on a broader spectrum, something to make the world a better place, not for just mankind, but for all kind. And that, to me, looked very seductive. That was very, and I don't mean that in the sexual aspect, but in the very, how do I get a part?
And how do I become that? And just being a 19-year-old girl in the world, entering, you know, what I thought was a professional organization, I was looking to those women as my authority figures, as people that I was striving to be. And I even think about Nancy Salzman and all the things that she was able to do that Keith was not. I mean, without her, he would not have been able to create ESP as it was. And so it was 75% women, maybe more. And that is also pretty disarming, because you look around and you're like, oh, you're like me, you're like me, you're not like me. But the familiarity of just being with women also put my guard down too.
You, like I said, I have to appreciate, now having watched the other documentary series, You see that there are many victims of this from all different aspects, famous filmmakers, actors, actresses, writers, executives, heiresses, mm-hmm. that are all under this control bubble, not stupid people by any means. But you can also see, and I don't mean this disrespectfully, almost like in their series, they were painting this kind of protective bubble for themselves. And what they revealed, you went to the jugular in Seduced, which I appreciated because it gave me right up front more of a taste of what this was. And to hear what Keith Raniere would spit out and say it in a disarming way, it was almost, as I watched it, I looked at him and I looked at the speaker that I worked for in Minnesota, and I saw these eerie similarities of, I'm going to say something so obnoxious and atrocious, you have to be like, what the fuck did you just say?
Yeah.
But then here comes the learning moment. And he would always point that out. But here's the learn. You're hearing this. That's good. I caught your attention. And you start playing this audio and video of Keith Raniere talking about rape. And, well, it's really only rape to people who allow it to be rape. Mm-hmm. And, oh my God, what did this guy just say?
And that is what he did. He did all these sorts of line bending type of strategies that sounds like your guy did too. And that's super strategic. I mean, he didn't do that just haphazardly. He was doing it in order to get a rise out of people. And that's an indoctrination tool. And we didn't know that.
Coming in and undermining what he just said, but in a way almost solidifying the gruesome point of what he just made in it. It was really unnerving to watch that play out. And you think on the whole, well, how did people not just look at this guy and go, I'm out, dude, you're nuts, you're a whack job. But again, he played it in a way and manipulated it and caused you to think, be alarmed, but let's take that alarm away because we're going to be empowered now. We're going to not do this and we're not going to allow ourselves to be victim. Oh, yeah, that's why I'm here. And you could see that shuffling of the cards. Mm-hmm. And it was so disarming to watch this unfold. That's why I immediately reached out to you when I watched your documentary. I'm like, God, the world needs to know this, because this applies in so many different things that go just outside of a cult.
Absolutely.
Out of that thinking, because, and I know you've been in contact with my wife and have chatted mm-hmm. with her online. my wife is a beautiful soul. She's a sweetheart of a human being. And she was in a brutally manipulative, abusive relationship, not with her ex-husband, but a high school relationship. And I sit back and I go, how do you stay in a relationship where a man beats you mercilessly and makes you feel like it's your fault? And watching shows like this is like, holy sh, that's how, because they're in your head, they're in playing you and playing your weaknesses, knowing that you want better, knowing and always giving you that sense that maybe there's redemption at the end of this cycle.
Right. And they've already eroded your self-esteem without you being aware of it through the indoctrination of their curriculum. And you, I could say this about anybody who is abusive or manipulative. And I do actually say quite a bit that you don't need to be in a cult to be coerced. Coercion exists in a one-on-one relationship. It can exist in a toxic work environment. It can be anywhere. And that was something that I wanted to also be clear in the series, is that this isn't exclusive to high control groups. And I've gotten so many messages from people like your wife who have experienced those types of horrendous abuses. And they say, watching this docuseries has helped me realize what was going on in my own life. And that gives me so much just joy and just sense of peace that this was a healing product, that this docuseries was able to shine a light in areas where we usually just want to look away. And I feel proud of that.
Oh, you've done a great job, and you did help. You helped me understand my wife and what she went through more, and respect for what she survived and how elegant she is in spite of what she came from.
Yeah, because it takes the average woman 7 times to leave an abusive relationship. So now imagine that, but in a group or in a family, like it's very hard to leave.
I have a question, and it's a harder question. And this isn't a sympathy for the devil, but a true wonder. You know, in the last few years, and thank God the Weinstein story blew up, because that's what allowed your mom to get through to the press. Finally, they could find a hook to talk about your story. Sometimes I stand back and I wonder, and I know it'll sound bad because I'm a man, do these celebrities that have involved themselves in some of these situations, are they also victims of their circumstance, that they start to believe the nonsense they hear? They see women throw themselves at them all the time. So do they just start to become like, well, this is how life is, and kind of lose touch? And I watching this, I wondered, did Keith Raniere begin this quest as someone who really did want to make a difference and became a victim of his own power? And when you create something that so many people start heaping onto you, that, oh my God, you're a god, oh, you've done, do you start to buy into your own nonsense? And that, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there was ever a thread of Keith that was a decent guy trying to create something to change the world, and he lost it somewhere along the line? Or was this always a dark manipulation? And I'm not asking for you to stand up for him.
No. This is a really good question, because this is a question that I struggled with a lot personally when I was leaving the group and I was trying to figure out what the heck just happened to me. And if there was any, you know, shred of truth or legitimacy to the things that they were telling me while I was inside of the group. So I was trying to just figure that out for myself. And what I've come to realize is that Keith Raniere has been doing this for decades. And unfortunately, even back in his CBI days, which was this kind of Costco-esque company that he created back in the 90s, he was abusing women, especially minors. And so for me, it was difficult to rationalize that this wasn't just how this man has always been, and that maybe the power and the prestige that he was getting from his work within Nexium corrupted him. I actually have come to realize that he has always been like this. Unfortunately, I think he was even a troubled teenager. And And he's had a pattern of this behavior throughout many years. And even I found out later while I was actually filming Seduced that one of the people that we interviewed was an ex-girlfriend of his who he had given a master-slave contract to for their sexual relationship.
Wow.
And so my mouth just dropped open because I was like, what? 20 years ago? So he's had these ideas ruminating in his mind, and he was just looking for the best way to execute them. And he was practicing on people along the way, as you can see in the situation with Daniela, who we talk about in Seduced, and her being trapped in a room for 2 years with no lock on the door, but she was psychologically and emotionally trapped. And I think that's a hard thing for people to understand and also to have compassion for.
And again, I wasn't trying to find sympathy for the devil, folks. It's to try to, because I know a lot of people think, oh boy, did this guy just get so wrapped up in his own hype that he just became a victim of his own deal? But you're pointing out
a good question. It's a really good question, because I think it matters even as a survivor or a victim, whatever you want to call yourself, to know the root of what you're dealing with so that you can identify it in other areas. Because, you know, people make mistakes, people do things that are bad, that are hurtful. But if you see a pattern of that behavior that is just unacceptable in my mind for decades, that's very clear to me that this person isn't able to be in society safely.
Right. Now, let's dive in. You're in this, you go into it with all the great thoughts and ideas and concepts of becoming a better India, becoming a better human, helping humanity become a better place and a better world. How soon do you start to see the red flags pop up, though? And is it one of those deals where it's like, for every 10 good things, there's one crazy, and then you're like, but I can overlook that because I've got 10 good things.
It's kind of like that. It's a little bit more that way. So, I mean, I also like to say that, I mean, if there wasn't enough good, I don't think anybody would have stayed. So there had to be enough appeal for it to be desirable. And to me, I think that was the community and the friends that I was making and the things that I was learning at the time I thought were really interesting. And it was, there were red flags from the beginning. When I actually look back, I see them from day one when we were in the first 5-day intensive with my mother and I didn't notice those things. They weren't as overt to me because I was there taking it as a student. I wasn't there to critique it. You know, I'm probably the youngest person in the room. It's not my place to just stand there and go, oh, this is a load of bullshit. But no, I was there to absorb and to learn. My mom, on the other hand, was a little bit more overtly critiquing the curriculum. And I was so embarrassed at the time because I was trying to be a good student. My mom was on the back row laughing at what she called Nancy Solzman was gold sash.
Right.
And I just felt like, oh my God, my mom is humiliating me. But really, what my mom was doing was correct. She was listening to her gut instincts, which were telling her that something was weird. And for every weird thing, just as you said, there were justifications for why we would feel that way. The number one justification is this is a feel bad program, not a feel good program. So if you're feeling bad about things and you get that little feeling, that's a good thing. You should lean into that. You should look at that. That's like an area of limitation that you need to get over. And all of that languaging seems logical at the time because you're like, oh, all right, I'm here to push myself. That's the whole point of personal growth. So you accept that and you end up accepting that over and over and over again to the point where you don't really question. And that's what happened really when you became a coach and you decided to devote your life to Nexium. And so questioning things wasn't really part of the culture, although they like to pretend that it was.
Seduced, inside the Nexium cult, you can find it and find information. We have a link for the documentary on today's show, seduceddocumentary.com. Watch this series, folks. You need to see this because this will help you uncover a lot of things in your own life and perhaps give you the strength you need to face the realities of an abusive situation, relationship, or workspace that might be toxic. It's something that I think can empower, and I know will empower many people to see this story. And through India's eyes, we can become better because we can see the things that have made us all fallible to certain situations in our life. So check it out. I got to tell you, India, we have a paranormal show, obviously, Darkness Radio, where we talk about all the strange.
I know. That's always, I love that stuff.
But I'm reaching out to you. I'm like, how do I write to this woman to talk about this and write to her from Darkness Radio? I got to feel like she's got to be looking at, like,
know that I was a nerd.
Oh, thank God you're a nerd, because that fit in well for us to communicate. So thank you for accepting this invitation. The documentary series is called Seduced, Inside the NXIVM Cult, seducedocumentary.com. The link is on today's program. Go watch that, folks. Watch it for yourselves and see the story, because this is a story that needs to be heard, because I have a very bad feeling there is not just one Keith Raniere amongst us at any given time. There are many that run in the same sheep's clothing, and this should be your indoctrination to seeing what's out there and not falling to the prey of this. This also doesn't mean, and I love the fact that you don't, and you do this beautifully, and you're doing it right now. You and I get to see each other. Unfortunately, our viewers don't get to see us chatting with one another, but you glow with this beauty that shows that you're not cynical from the experience that you've lived through, but that it has made you, as tragic as it sounds, a better person, because you have come through. But you're not cynical to the nature of all humanity now, but you're more aware, and that's good.
I'd like to see.
Oh, well, you do. It's,
thank you.
It shows
I feel like I feel more myself now than I have in a very long time. And so I think I'm just really grateful to have my life now. I don't think it was something that I ever thought that I would need to fight for, to be honest. I mean, I grew up in Malibu, California with a loving family and, you know, opportunities. And I went off looking for something and I ended up in the belly of the beast. And I think for me, coming out of this has just been a lot about learning what I was made of. And my sort of toughness doesn't always look so tough on the outside, but I feel it on the inside a lot more than I used to. I feel like I can handle things. And that was something that I even went into NXIVM looking for, were just tools and how to handle the world. And I didn't know that my world was becoming smaller the more I dove into NXIVM. Mm-hmm. Whereas now that I'm out and I get to just experience the world for what it is in this new way, it's just so much more extraordinary than I thought. Yeah. I'm like, oh my God, I can do whatever I want. And that just feels really good. And so I guess happiness makes you look healthy.
And it looks great on you. You know, it's funny. And not to minimize your experience, but to hear your story, I almost feel like I'm talking to the human Pinocchio, right? You're this child who's born into a life that really has afforded you opportunity that a lot of people wouldn't, but you weren't satisfied. It wasn't, and I don't mean that in a bad thing. We should never be satisfied with staying in a position where we could ride the coattails of a famous mother and you know, family members like that. But you saw more, you wanted to be more, and you entered the belly of the beast. Like you said, you went out there and like Pinocchio, found all the wrong people that promised happiness and joy and great. And here's where you can get better. And then you realize, oh shit, this is not as what I was hoping for.
Yeah. Right? And, how did I get here?
Right. And you come out the other end, the real little boy, the real little girl has come out of this. And that's great to see. And I want people to focus on that, because you don't have to continually be a victim of the life and the choices you've made. You can stand back up. And we've talked about that for years in dealing with my own depression and anxiety. Mm-hmm. Those moments when you feel weakest are not what define you. It's getting back up, getting back out, and making something better. And that's what India has done with this documentary, by opening up and allowing you into her world to see that this isn't the moment. This isn't the one that says, oh, this is who India Oxenberg is. No, this is just watching the chrysalis of how she grows. And it's a great story in a horrible setting. So watch the documentary. And you know what? If you have daughters and sons or people you feel vulnerable in your life that might be in a bad situation, maybe watch this documentary with them without telling them why you're sharing it. Just watch it together. And maybe that will start to open their eyes to the circumstances within their own life. And I think it could be really helpful in so many ways. Now, I know we don't have a lot of time, and I'm specifically not getting super deep into a lot of this, folks, not because India asked me not to, but because I want you to watch the damn documentary series. I want you to see it for yourself, because us chatting about it, we're not going to do it as much service. But I'd be remiss to say, you're in this, you start seeing the red flags. Your mom is reaching out, and I do love the fact that your mom makes a very hard point in one point of her journey on this. She says, I'm pushing my daughter away, but I would rather have her hate me and help her than end up, I guess, essentially hating herself for not stepping in. And when you're a parent, we have to make tough decisions, which are going to make us real unpopular. But when it comes to a parent's love, you don't get that courtesy of, well, I'll just let them learn. No, you do what's right. And your mom did what's right. And unfortunately for Nexium, they fucked with the wrong woman, because
yeah, they did.
They pulled the pin on that kid. Yeah. They pulled the pin on Kathy.
Just a side note, something silly. And then we can go back to where we were heading. But for Christmas, I bought my mom a bunch of stationery that says, don't fuck with Catherine Oxenberg. So she can write all of her letters and her notes on it. And I already gave her a little piece of it on Thanksgiving to just surprise her. And she's like, oh my God, this is the best. But yeah, no, they definitely screwed with the mom, with the wrong tiger mom. That's for sure. And I think for me, being so, you know, so sucked in to the group at that point, I just couldn't see what my mom was doing for what it really was, which was entirely from love. And that is what my mom did. And we later on discussed it at length, that that was an excruciating decision for her, because she thought that she was going to lose our relationship forever. But she also couldn't live with the fact that maybe she would lose me. Right. And so she made that decision. And I was totally scared and confused and angry, and I felt betrayed and all of these things and all the influence and pressure that I was feeling from the group while I was still in there. And I was being pushed farther and farther from my mother, the person who was trying to help me. So it was a very difficult time for both of us.
That shows the real conviction of the conceit that is Keith Raniere. Because I would tell you myself, if I realized that within my midst, I have a potential bomb, my thought would not be, bring it on. My thought would be, you know what? Maybe we should send India home. Maybe this isn't the right place for her, because her mom's starting to cut nerves. And
I like a war chicken, like, right. Here, take it.
Yeah. Had he cut you loose, he might still be out there doing this without Catherine and India Oxenberg being the catalyst for this change. He could have preyed on so many more people over these years and caused so much more destruction. So it's fascinating to see that his conceit was so much that he wasn't afraid of anything. Or I wonder, you know, this guy teased it out to people. It was almost like he was begging to be caught from the get-go.
I know. That's the weird part. Like, and I've thought about this too a lot. It's like almost hiding in plain sight, because even you see in the docuseries how we reference certain archival footage where he's just so blunt about what he is actually doing. And no one really noticed. That was one of the weirder things for me to watch after I left and look at all the things that he did that were so obviously not what someone would do if they were trying to hide from being caught. So,
which is what makes most serial killers really good, is because they hide in plain sight. There's nothing extraordinary about their look or about what they do. They're just there being human. And then this dark side, which is terrifying. But, you know, it's interesting and telling to me, and I know there are so many people that probably have the same question. You play the audio, and you, at the end of this, Alice and Mac's family, you were living with Allison and her wife at the time, and Allison gets arrested, and her mom asks you to send things home, and you find zip sticks. You find the little, what are they called? I can't think of the word. Flash drives. And you keep them and forget about them. But it was like the aha moment was when you found them. That's what crushed this case for them. And to hear this story, and I don't want to say exactly what it, but he admitted, did he not know he was being recorded all the time?
No, of course he did. He wanted it. He was so narcissistic that he needed everything to be recorded, everything to be videotaped. He wanted archival footage because he thought he was that extraordinary and that he was actually changing the world. So that's more of an insight into his pathology and what he desired. But I mean, like my flash drives were a very important piece to the prosecution. But I mean, there were so many people who testified even before I was out of the group that gave them insights about what this man had been doing for decades, and brave women who had left. They testified, and they, you know, multiple witnesses and people who went and spoke in front of a grand jury just to bring this case to life. So, I mean, I'm flattered by the fact that you think that it's me and my mom, and we certainly did our part, but there are so many people involved in bringing this down. And I think that's one of the things that people don't realize is how much it takes to actually dismantle a system like this. And
there look were, at Miramax. There were, right. There were other people, certainly, but like I said, you were the catalyst to break the final back, because unfortunately, and this is a double-sided sword, we've seen it on our show in True Crime before, there are laws to protect both the perpetrator and the victims. And unfortunately, me coming forward and saying Keith Raniere did this, Keith Raniere did that, I might have a bone to pick with Keith Raniere, mm-hmm. especially all the people that left NXIVM and were disavowed by him. Could we have an axe to grind? So there's that. But you brought in the evidence that wasn't just Dave Schrader saying Keith Raniere did this, Keith Raniere did that. I felt broken. You had the fucking audio of him saying, yeah, I want you to hold them down, but I want you to make them beg for it. And I want you to make them ask for this so that, you know, there's no coercion. He knew what he was doing, and he recorded it.
He knew exactly what he was doing from the beginning, and he created all of it. And it was all from him. Without his brain creating these disturbing, horrible things that he wanted to do to people, this wouldn't have happened. This wouldn't have existed. I really believe that anybody who interacted with Keith Raniere, including myself, was a victim of Keith, because that's what he does. He victimizes people. He gets what he needs out of them and then uses them like pawns. So I don't really have any anger or judgment to any of the people who behaved weirdly while they were in the group that have now left, that, you know, want to start their lives over. I don't have any bad blood, because I know that we were all under the influence while we were there, and we are not the same people that went in as we are now.
And folks, I do want to address something about that. Under the influence. Oh, well, they're, and I know it. Just save yourself the time of sending me the emails. I don't want to hear you tell me how they're all nuts and they were all crazy, because they weren't. They were manipulated. And for those of you that don't know the full story, it wasn't just people being broken psychologically. They gave things to the organization that could hurt their friends and families and loved ones. And it was done in a covert way to it. In here's where it snowballs and gets away from you, right? You're told, hey, there's this part of our organization that is specialized to women. We are going to take this further. We're going to empower women. We're going to do this. There's a secret women's group, but I got to know that you're committed to this. Just tell me something you wouldn't want anyone else to know, so that I know that if I tell you this, you're not going to just go out and blab about it okay, well, yeah, I get that. You want me to listen, we have to have skin in the game. You don't give a dog away for free and expect somebody to treat it well. You bring them to the Humane Society, you pay for it. When somebody pays for it, there's more value to it. So I got that aspect, but give us a naked picture. Give us some info on your mom. Well, okay, you don't have any info, but give me something inflammatory like your mom.
Why don't you just make it up?
Right, just make it up, because that way, at least if you do that, we could drop this bomb. So if you try to screw us by letting the world know this little secret, which didn't seem like a dirty painted secret, but like a sisterhood.
Not at all. It was pitched to me as a secret sorority, and what you're referring to, so just to make the distinction, what you're talking about is DOS, which was the secret sorority within NXIVM that Keith Raniere created to recruit and funnel women and groom them to be obedient soldiers. And we didn't know that that was what the plan was. We were being pitched that this is a secret sorority for you to grow and for you to push yourself to the next level, exclusively women coaching women. And I was like, great, that sounds exactly what I need. Because at that point, I was really being, I was being held at a certain point of my growth as a coach, if that makes sense. Like they decided if you excelled or not. And so I was stagnant in one spot, and I was feeling kind of desperate for the next move because I wanted to grow and advance in the organization. So when DOS was pitched to me, it was pitched to me as entirely different and separate from ESP. And
you know, doesn't even know about this. This is something we're doing for us, right? Isn't that kind of the pitch?
It was a big lie. And it wasn't until we were already compromised with Collateral, which is blackmail, we were told at that point we had to recruit other people. We were never even told that from the beginning. We weren't even really told any details about the brand. We were told it was a tattoo. And I mean, I laugh a little bit because it's so crazy to me now to think about that decision point and how it really just changed my whole life and also affected a lot of other people because I had to recruit other women and I had to conceal things from them, which felt awful, but I was already collateralized and I was being forced to recruit and to give them other commands. And all of that was really uncomfortable for me because I am not a naturally kind of aggressive, confrontational person. And so to go up against other people who are pushing back felt really like really weird.
And she mentioned branding, which was a big part of it. If you were living under a rock and didn't hear that aspect of the story that was splashed out across newspaper headlines, they would brand with this unique symbol that represented the elements. There was fire and mountains and air and this and that. And when we saw it, I looked right at my wife and I said, Jesus Christ, that's Allison Mack's initials. It looks like a big AM. And then when they tipped it on its side, right, they tip it on the side and it's a KR. I was like, what?
We did not know that. So even the day that we were being branded, we were told by Allison that this was a symbol of the elements. So what am I supposed to do? Just question her till I get punished? No, I just said, okay, I can accept that. It kind of vaguely looked like it could be some weird alien symbol of the elements or something like that. And so I kind of, at the time, I felt like, proud, like I was getting a brand or a tattoo with girls, women that I cared about, and that was going to be something tough that we were going to overcome together, and it was going to be a bonding experience. That's how it was pitched to us.
Right.
Later on, I realized it's literally the opposite. It's an enslavement tool and a branding tool that people often use in prostitution. And that to me was so disturbing. And then on top of it, getting the affirmation through the tapes that it was Keith Raniere's initials. And actually many people had reported that it was also Allison Mack's, but it wasn't because Keith would never share that kind of attention with anybody else but himself. So it really, it's K-A-R.
It does, you know, it also makes you wonder if he was leaving in a line of plausible deniability that if it looked enough like Allison Max, he could put it off on her because she was the one supposedly spearheading this aspect of this secret sorority.
Yeah, and I think he did that strategically. If that's what he did it strategically in order to hurt Allison.
Right. Now, you have all of these people that you were associated with. You know, it's easy from the outside to sit in judgment and say, well, you had all these opportunities to walk away because essentially you were being held captive in a room without a lock as well. And you chose not to. But hey, what people don't pay attention to is the fact that you had made a commitment to yourself, which is an important commitment, and a commitment to this organization. And then you were making a commitment to the friends and relatives that you had betrayed by giving false narratives about things that, you know, to do this. So there was a lot more heaped on the shoulders of a person, and thinking maybe there's going to be a good end. Maybe at the end of this, there's going to be something. So it's weird, but as you start to watch the walls crumble, I had to guess that there was, you know, everybody says, oh, she was still, and she was still under the spell, and your mom was worried that you were still under the spell. And help me out if I'm wrong on this. I saw in your face and eyes during that time in the little video vignettes, I kind of felt like you were out of the spell, but you were like, I don't know where I belong even more now. And do I go home and face my family knowing what I've done and knowing, or do I keep standing on my own ground until I find my footing and I'm able to walk out of the fire? What was that like for you?
It was more like that for me, because I was trying to just stay afloat. And I left Albany in February 2018, and I moved to New York City to look for work, because everything around me was falling apart. And I thought, well, if I can just get a job and support myself and just put my head down, then maybe I'll make it through this mess. And I thought it would just kind of, you know, roll over and this would be yesterday's news. But that did not happen. And I was constantly being harassed by the paparazzi, chased around the East Village. They were coming into my work. It was a very chaotic and scary time for me, because I was just trying to figure out what the fuck just happened to me in the last 7 years of my life, but also under an extraordinary amount of adrenaline. Like, am I going to be arrested? What's going to happen to these people who I think are my friends? What's going to happen to my family if I say anything? Like, all of that. It was I had a lot of fear, to the point where I just didn't even want to think about it. And all I wanted to do was go to the restaurant and do my job and go home and pretend that that didn't exist. And at that point, I was still kind of estranged from my mother. And we weren't really speaking until about June of 2018, when we first had our meeting together and we saw each other in person for the first time. And that was really intense. And we both felt very nervous to be with each other, which we had never felt before.
You said this was just at the time, you know, it took a while for you and your mom to meet, but I wanted to stop because doing a paranormal show, there's a moment that literally choked me up in the program, where your mom doesn't know where you are. Your mom is lost and wants her daughter back. And she's walking the streets of New York for a TV show talking, and she stops in front of this brownstone and sits on the step and starts talking. And unbeknownst to her, she's sitting on your front stoop. And to me, that if that's not an indication of how tied we really are as humanity, right, that shows that how important our links to one another are. And your mom found you without even knowing she found you. When you saw that footage, was it on the, did you think, oh shit, she knows where I am?
No, it actually happened a little different. I didn't know that she was shooting for People magazine or something like that. And back when she was going to be publishing her book, and I had no idea that she was, you know, in Brooklyn. I had no idea that she was even that close to me. And it wasn't until we met that summer, so June, July, 2018, that I took her to where I lived. And I wasn't living there anymore, because that was Allison's old apartment and I had moved out. But she stopped me and she pointed at the stoop and she said, you're not going to believe this, but that's where we stopped and took these photographs. And in the background, you can see my bedroom window. And so we were that close without even realizing that we were that connected. And I mean, both of us just started crying because we couldn't believe that after all of this, we were still kind of on the same path, but fighting from different sides. It's like I had to fight from the inside and she had to fight from the outside, but we were never really not aligned because, I mean, it's my mother and my, my heart will always be with her. I just got very, very sidetracked. I mean, it's an understatement. Yeah.
It was a powerful moment to see that play out, and I know our fans of the paranormal aspect will dig that piece as well, because it is so powerful, again, to see that connection between just us as humans. Kind of wrapping up with you, because I know your time is short with me. I've got to guess, there were great things that you learned in NXIVM. There were tools. And I know Scientology has been compared a lot to NXIVM and their ideologies and their breaking people and getting kind of their information to use against them later. And you guys had Emmys, which was very similar, how to break you of these bad thoughts and trying to take ownership. And as I believe they said, you had more than anybody had ever had.
I definitely had a good amount of EMs. That's for sure. They were very similar to kind of therapeutic techniques and what Scientology uses to break stimulus response patterns. And really what I didn't realize is that the EM is a tool to break you of your emotional responses. So you think that you're becoming, you know, more capable of handling things, but really you're actually becoming more numb to stimuluses.
And do you find that in your daily life now, you can still utilize tools that you learned that were positive tools, ways to help you, or is it even too painful yet to pluck those strings of the web? Even though you know that some of these tools are effective in getting you to a better place, how does that work for you now?
That's a good question. I mean, initially, therapy, for instance, was very triggering. And it was hard for me. I didn't even want to do it because we had done so much, you know, air quotes here, talk therapy-esque things in NXIVM that I was really like grossed out by it. And when I got out, I was like, that is not for me. No more personal growth, no more therapy, no more this. I just kind of wanted to think for myself. And then I realized, hold on a minute. There's some nuggets out of all of this stuff that I can take with me and reincorporate into my life. And it's not exclusive to NXIVM. I consider myself more of a spiritual person and my connection to my soul is very important. And I wanted to rebuild that and feel good about myself. And so I've actually relied a lot on a lot of tools and tools that you could say are kind of personal growth related, where if it's just positive affirmations or reframing things in a way that serves me and benefits me and also doesn't drag me down. So I've had to do a lot of reincorporating of things that I've learned throughout the years and make it right for me now in my life, because before it came from obligation and now it comes from curiosity and just a desire to grow as a person and to be happier and to feel more at ease and less, you know, knocked by things in the world. So I use a lot of different tools and I really rely on exercise a lot. That's been a really helpful tool. Whereas in NXIVM and specifically in DOS, that was used inappropriately. I mean, they were forcing us to starve and to do excessive exercise and to restrain our eating and all of these things that I've had to unlearn and relearn what works for me. And I'm still doing it. I'm still learning new things all the time about how to handle this stuff better.
We mentioned at the start of this that Keith had a predilection for young underage girls. Do you think that's part of why he tried to enforce in women to starve? I mean, was he trying to get all of you to look more like children?
Yes, it was for his own sexual desires. And he liked that. And he also did things that many other cult leaders do, which is control your food and control what you eat. He enforced a lot of vegetarianism with people, which is quite common, and also restrictive eating, and all kind of guised under this self-help vibe that this is going to help you be stronger, impulse control, discipline, you know, self-respect, all throwing around all the words that, you know, you usually want to have for yourself, but you don't do it from a place of fear or obligation. That's not healthy.
Luckily, you did not have to testify. Am I understanding that correctly?
Correct. I was a cooperating witness for 9 months with the FBI, and that took up all of my life, basically,
right.
And was really intense. And then at the last minute, I was called from testifying because Lauren Salzman, Nancy Salzman's daughter, gave an extraordinarily extensive testimony that kind of took me off of the stand. And I was actually really grateful for that, because the people who had to testify went through a lot in cross-examination and just went through a lot emotionally. And some of those people are my dear friends. And I remember feeling really scared. But I did speak. I spoke at Keith's sentencing and I read my victim impact statement. And that was the closure that I needed.
And I wanted to ask, you know, was there closure in that for you? Was there closure in addressing him finally and stating what your heart had always felt?
Absolutely. I mean,
good.
I didn't know what it was going to feel like. I couldn't compare it to anything else that I had experienced. So I was definitely nervous and I had to do a lot of self-coaching that day just to prepare myself for seeing him and being in court. And I also got to witness 14 other victim impact statements. So it was a very powerful and intense day.
Did it show, how do I want to phrase this? Do you believe that any of what you or the other victims said to him impacted him in any way on a human scale? Or was he just unfazed by you?
You know, I went into it knowing that I wasn't going to get anything from him.
Right.
And I think if you go in with an expectation that you're going to get closure or you're going to get a rise out of him, or maybe he'll cry, like, good luck. Because that's not
right.
A sociopath. That's just not, he's incapable of feeling empathy. And that was just an additional affirmation of what I already knew, which was that he does not feel for us. On the contrary, he actually called us liars after we spoke and said that he wasn't guilty and that he was innocent of these crimes and that basically we had changed our minds last minute about him. And I was like, dude, there's no mind changing here. Like, this is the truth. This is reality. Like, get with it. And he couldn't. And so really our statements impacted the judge to the point where you'll like this. But initially the judge was going to give him 56 years. And he started off saying, you know, breaking it down and using all of these legal terms to decide why he should have this length of time in this category. It was like 7 different categories. And after everybody spoke and Keith Raniere basically pretended to be a martyr and still innocent, like an innocent lamb. And it was kind of astonishing that he even behaved like that without any remorse or, you know, just expressing guilt, nothing. I mean, like, I can barely talk. It was so shocking. And after that, the judge decided to give him 120 years. And so that was huge.
Yeah. Well, and the one last aspect I'm curious about, I know this is just your perception because you're not everyone else, but this has been broken up for quite a while. Keith Raniere has been in custody. The sentencing just went down. I mean, that's how raw all of this is. But why do you believe that there are still supporters that haven't, after seeing this and hearing the audio and the videos and seeing this play out, what's going on? Why would there still be conviction for this man?
Well, for one, I know how difficult it is to leave a group like this and how much influence and control they have over you in your life. And a lot of the people who are still loyal to Keith probably don't look at the news and won't read the court transcripts because they've been discouraged from getting actual information. They've been told that it's fake or that it's distorted or it's a conspiracy against them. So they're still kind of running on the same cult indoctrination. Like, they haven't broken out of that bubble and they're not able to see reality for what it is. I feel a lot of sadness for them because they don't have their lives back fully and they're still being used and controlled by Keith Raniere, whether they want to accept it or not. But it's also their choice, and they have to want to see the truth. And it's painful because you have to confront things that you've done or decisions that you've made while you were in the group that you might feel completely distasteful or embarrassing. I know for myself, I've had to accept a lot of things. And it's scary to have to look at your life and think, oh my God, what was I doing for the past 5, 7, 12, 2 years? And to then face yourself and come out of it. So they're up against a lot in breaking free. And I just think there's people who are still there. There's probably people who are going to still be loyal to him forever, but that doesn't really look all that different to me than Charles Manson.
Right. Do you think in their case, though, that they're loyal to the ideology of what they thought they were a part of as opposed to the man?
I think both. Okay. I think there's people who are loyal to Keith and what they believe he represents, like Nikki Klein. And I think there's people who are really adamant that the trainings and the curriculum and the messages that they were putting out were good. And so they're, you know, holding on to that as tight as they can because they don't want to look at it any other way.
Well, I want you to know that I appreciate your time on today's show. I appreciate the work that you put into these documentaries and the opening that you've made. This cannot be easy to be open and raw and expose aspects of your life and what you were a part of. So I hope that you, in times of weakness, recall these moments of strength that this is really who you are.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's really been a pleasure getting to speak to someone who has so much heart.
It's, you know, as like I said, as a father, it's something hard to watch, and you pray that your children never go through bad relationships, bad decisions, bad work environments, places where they feel trapped. And seeing someone come out of it and doing it so beautifully like you've done, I think is going to be a really good point that will be a mark that you'll make on the world that will far surpass anything that you were ever a part of with Nexium. So please keep that in your heart as you progress as well on this journey. And we hope that you'll visit with us in the future if there's other aspects or follow-ups that you do on this. And we want
to
pass our best wishes on to you and to your mother for her strength involved in this story, and to all those that came to the aid to make sure that this man was taken down and will never, like you said, you're part of a bigger system to take this guy down and to dissemble this horrible cult. And so pass our well wishes on to all of those. Have you learned yet to forgive yourself for all of this and the people that are around you, or is that still a work in progress?
Definitely a work in progress. I think there's so many layers to healing and forgiveness. And I think I definitely feel better about it now than I used to. So I found a lot of peace.
Good. Well, we will pray for your health and happiness and mental stability as you move forward in this world. So thank you. All right, folks, watch the documentary. I mean, there's other shows out there, but go to the one source that will really show you the true depth of this entire case, this entire story, Seduced, Inside the Nexium Cult, NXIVM. If you're trying to look it up, we've got a link for it on today's program guide so that you can find it easily and access it. Our guest, of course, India Oxenberg, and we will keep our listeners abreast of what's going on and all the changes and updates in this story as well. This isn't all that we're going to discuss in cults. As a matter of fact, we have a friend of yours, India, who's going to be joining us, Dr. Ross, who is going to talk to us about cults.
Amazing.
And talk to us about the Heaven's Gate cult and Nexium and what it's, you know, the psychologies behind this. So he's agreed to come on and join us on this program as well.
Please say hi from me to him. He's so certainly great.
Will do. All right. I do this every week, Tim. I say we're going to go into dumb crimes and stupid criminals, and then I ramble on a few more minutes about something else. But today we're going to ramble about something really important. And I asked our guests to stay for just a few more minutes because that's how important it is. How do you like that? So before we launch into dumb crime, stupid criminals, India, you have got a great foundation that you're part of in raising money to help people that are survivors of cults and other situations. Can you describe that to us a little bit, and how can people help?
Yes, of course. It's actually called the Catherine Oxenberg Foundation. It was founded by my mother while I was still in NXIVM, and she was helping all sorts of people who were leaving NXIVM, but also high control groups, human trafficking, domestic violence. And so we are working to raise money so that we can have more resources to provide therapy and finances so that these people can restart their lives. Because oftentimes people who leave cults are either destitute, they've lost connection with their families and with their prior careers, and it's very difficult to start your life up again. And that was the greatest gift, amongst other things, that my mom gave to me, which was an open heart and an open arms for anything that I needed in order to heal. And I want to be able to give that to other people. So it's the Catherine Oxenberg Foundation, and you can donate there.
We have a link for that on today's program as well. And folks, the holidays are here. The time of giving is here. No matter what you can afford to give, give, because there are many people in a much worse place that need that help and need a chance to get their foot back in the door. And since we are in the month and time of charity, let's all dig a little deep and make a difference in this. And we'll see if we can do some fun stuff here in the future. Now that I know you're a nerd, we may actually do a you know what, when COVID lifts and we can do something, what I'd like to do is host a private paranormal investigation that I'll lead. And everybody that chips in and will be a part of this will donate all the money right to the Catherine Oxenberg Foundation and help raise money. Okay.
Love that. Do I get to see ghosts?
Yes. Yeah. If you want to come play, well, I'll show you some haunted spots.
Oh my God. Here we go.
it's a lot of fun. So we'll get you out there and investigate, or we'll just do this and raise some money. But folks, don't wait for me to do that to make your donations now, because these donations count. So go help out. India, thank you so much. Merry Christmas and happy holidays to you and your family. All right, folks, take a deep breath if you need to stand up and shake it off and do what you need to. Go get a drink of water, then come on back and let's have a little fun. We're going to kick open the case files because, believe it or not, there's dumb people doing dumb things, and we're going to report on it next. Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals right here on True Crime Tuesday.
It's Crayon News Storytime.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, dumb crime, stupid criminals, Tim. We begin in Texas this week. We're going to give Florida a little break.
Okay.
I don't know if you saw this footage, but a Texas high school football player has been arrested for attacking a ref. Emmanuel Duran was already facing an assault charge for blindsiding a ref during a high school football game in Texas. On Monday, he learned the attack will cost him the rest of his high school athletic career. Members of Texas University Interscholastic League Executive Committee voted 5-0 on Monday to suspend Duran from competing in athletics for the remainder of the 2020 to 2021 school calendar, according to the Monitor in McAllen. As a senior, Duran's run as a high school sports star in South Texas is over. A standout defensive lineman for Edinburgh High School, Duran was named an all-area wrestler last season and was expected to compete for a statewide wrestling championship in the spring. He was also the football team's kicker and punter and named District 31-6A Defensive Player of the Year in 2019. The UIC also announced that Edinburgh football coach J.J. Leha will be placed on probation for the 2021-2022 school year. The school's entire athletic department will be placed on probation immediately through the 2023 school year. Further violations during the probationary period may lead to additional punishment that could include the school's athletic department being barred from postseason play for up to 3 years. Now, here's what happened. Okay. Did you say you've seen this video, Tim, or no?
I have not. No. Oh, is this the hitting the kid in the head? No, nope.
Here, I'm going to show you.
Okay.
This is the kid running out on the field after a call and taking out the ref. So here's the link for it, Tim. You scroll down a little bit and look at this while I read the story. The punishment stems from an incident during Edinburgh's 35-21 victory over Farran San Juan Alamo on December 3rd. During the game, officials flagged Duran for roughing the passer in unsportsmanlike conduct. The second flagged appeared to stem from Duran contesting the roughing penalty during an exchange with an official. Referee Fred Garcia announced the penalties and Duran's ejection from the game. Duran then ran from the sideline and slammed Garcia to the turf. The 58-year-old official was turned the other way when Duran attacked him. The incident was captured in video. Police escorted Duran from the game after the attack. Garcia was treated on the scene for shoulder injury and concussion-like symptoms. He didn't return to the game, according to the Monitor. Edinburgh qualified for the playoffs with that win. The Edinburgh Consolidated Independent School District removed the team from the postseason the next day because of the attack. Oh, so you cost your entire team for being a dipshit. Duran was charged that same Friday with assault causing bodily injury and held on a $10,000 bond that was posted that evening. Duran released a statement after Monday's decision. I'd like to say that I'm sorry for what happened to my coaches, my family, and the UIL. That's all he wrote. Do you see that footage?
So he'd like to say he's sorry, but he's not? Is that the deal?
I guess he's going to say he's sorry, but watch him. Just, you know, they walk him off the field. They walk him off the field. He just can't stop looking at the ref. The ref makes the call, and then all of a sudden, pandemonium unleashes. I'll have this on today's news story. Yeah. So if you go to Darkness Radio and click on the news tab, you'll be able to watch the footage as the ref is walking across the field. All of a sudden, boom!
Okay, I have a little bit of problem with the technique.
Yeah, what, his tackle technique?
Yeah, it's not really a tackle technique, and it's horrible. First of all, when you're playing Texas football, first of all, you should be good at technique. He didn't. He neither lifted the referee off his feet nor really ran him over. That's,
are you advocating that he could have done better in abusing the ref?
He could have. This is not a hit, really. This is, I mean, he barely, I mean,
disagree with you. He lifts this guy up and knocks him on his ass.
I don't
Boom.
Know if he lifted him. I
Are
mean,
you
he
fucking high. He lifts up off the ground by about a foot and a half.
Look, no, it wasn't a foot and a half. Oh, he barely got him off his heels. I mean, this was go, this kid starting
and then wipe them and then put them back on. And watch it.
My glasses are clean. I'm of sound mind and body. And
your ref,
and I'm looking at this. You're talking to a guy who played football, son. And I'm looking at this. And
you took too many hits to the head. Then.
No. I'm telling you, I've put many a man into the ground, and this is just disappointing. This is.
Oh, don't listen to him, kid.
If you're going to get suspended for the rest of your career, you take him. You take him out.
No, don't. That's the
worst
advice ever.
You take him out.
Dave Schrader, defense attorney at law, will not. I repeat, will not be protecting Tim Dennis's rights. Should anybody?
He barely brushed him.
Well, here we go. Our next headline: man busted for duct taping a flashlight to his car for headlights. I don't understand why he has to be arrested for that. It's ingenuity, I say.
I do have a related deal to this after you're done with the story, but go ahead.
If it has anything to do with hitting officials, I don't want
to hear. No. It has to do with another similar vehicle, but go ahead.
Well, those are illegal. Aftermarket headlights and housings are convenient ways to add some visual pizzazz to a vehicle. They can transform a car from mundane to eye-catching, though if the upgrade is done incorrectly, it could catch the eye of the law. That's what happened to one Washington man last week when police pulled him over in his modified Chevy Impala with some not-so-legal replacement headlights. The Impala, which appears to have lingering damage from a front-end accident, replaced its missing headlights with a pair of flashlights duct-taped to the car. Washington State Police car on the I-90 east of Seattle around 2 a.m. The responding officer noticed the unusually dim headlights, which were caused by the flashlight's draining batteries. When police pulled over the man, they also discovered he had a suspended driver's license. Could this guy have just put a bigger spotlight on himself? Yeah, probably could have, but he would have forgot batteries, so it wouldn't have shown him. The U.S. Federal Motor Vehicle Safety Standards automakers must adhere to voluminous, that's the rules. Those are all the rules regulating all lights, not just headlights. The FMVSS is one reason the U.S. lacks vehicles with adaptive driving beam headlights like those offered on the Cadillac XT6 that aren't offered on the U.S. spec models, though there is building pressure for the government to update the rules. It's also why the police stopped the car. Even the state's motor vehicle code references the FMVSS. The flashlights also posed a safety threat. Automakers have to ensure the headlights are a certain brightness to illuminate the road ahead adequately, and dim flashlights, well, Tim, they fall well below that requirement. Improper lighting, especially at night, can hide potential. Why do I say potential? No. Potential. Tim, somebody had potential obstacles that are in the way until it's too late to avoid them, causing an accident, especially on the highway, where headlights are pushed to their limits. While we're hopeful regulators will eventually update the county's lighting rules, we're certain those makeshift headlights would still be illegal.
Yeah, you got to have enough lumens in the in order to be able to see.
It's a related story.
Okay, so I'm driving along the other day, and there's a truck in front of me. And first of all, it's an old pickup truck. Like, it's got to be at the very least, it's early 70s. It might be 1970. It might even be from the 60s. And I'm talking just the box, like, you know, the two-wheel box. And barely the other four wheels are hanging on, and the cab is non-existent. So the bed of the cab is barely there. There's just the floor of the bed, okay? There's no walls. There's no nothing to the bed. And the guy has what are supposed to be the taillights of the bed strapped. It's literally just two... I don't know if he's got two... like flashlights, like you said, in two little red lights in the back of the what's supposed to be the bumper, and they're like those little ratchet straps, you know.
Yeah.
That's what's holding the taillights onto the bumper. And I thought, wow, welcome to Minnesota. You must have moved here from Florida, because there's no way that works. And I'm thinking, you're driving around town and not a cop has stopped you. I watched two cops drive past this guy. It didn't stop him once. I don't know how this setup is legal, but congrats, buddy. You made it. I didn't see any wiring going from the truck back to any harness to power this thing. It just looked like it was strapped onto the bumper and that it was just powered by some battery. I didn't know what it was.
Because you fart and not signal, and the cops are all over you, Tim.
Yeah, I know. Oh, I know. Yeah. Yeah. But this guy didn't.
And they had a ref.
He didn't have a turn signal. He didn't have a brake light. I mean, he had one brake light over the back of the. Well, it had to be post 1970, because he had one little brake light above the on the back of the cab, over the, you know, over the top of the cab. He had a tiny little brake light there so that we didn't slam into him, but you know, but that was it. That's all he had on the rig. But yeah, go Gomer.
The Polk County Sheriff's Office has a story to share with us. Fresh off the dockets, Tim.
Did one of their sheriffs get slammed on a football field?
No. On Wednesday, a deputy noticed a white Buick driving with no tag near the intersection of 5th Street Northeast and Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in the Haven of Winter, and conducted a traffic stop. The vehicle came to a stop in the parking lot of an apartment complex, and the deputy made contact with the driver, 35-year-old Julian, who for some reason decided to step out of his car. We suggest that you do not do this during a traffic stop, no, unless the officer or deputy tells you to do so. When asked for his driver's license, Julian said he did not have it on him. He then started walking backwards away from the deputy, which we also advise you do not do this. The deputy then grabbed Julian's arm to keep him from running, and Julian began to struggle with the deputy. Again, just no. That's what this is all in the report. I'm just reading it exactly. And again, it says just no. The deputy eventually secured Julian in handcuffs and placed into the back of a patrol car. The deputy discovered that for the reason Julian didn't have his license on him was because he wasn't or hasn't had a legal license since 2010. Wow. 10-year anniversary of driving illegally. Congratulations, Julian.
Yeah.
like to celebrate by putting you in jail. The deputy also discovered several different pills, a digital scale, a black tar substance, a brown powder substance, a white rock substance, a brown waxy liquid substance, which just sounds gross, and a green leafy substance. That's a lot of substances. Some of these were trafficking amounts of substances, as a matter of fact, Tim. It was determined that these were heroin, cocaine, MDMA, which is ecstasy, a.k.a. Molly, as the kids are calling it, alprazolam, and marijuana. Julian was charged with, well, he was charged with a lot, Tim, but the story doesn't stop there. During the arrest, Julian's mom showed up, and she was not happy. Yeah, she wasn't angry at her son for having trafficked amounts of hard drugs in his car. She was hacked off at the deputies at the scene. They wouldn't let her talk to Julian while the investigation was still ongoing. She continually stepped into the crime scene after being told not to. Again, not a good plan. She then started recording on her cell phone. That one is okay. Julian's mama then called 911. Never do this when deputies are right there with you. It is called misuse of 911, by the way, Tim.
Is it?
You know, moms love their sons, but enough was enough, and mama was told she was under arrest, to which she said, "No, I'm good," and began walking away. The deputy detained her, cuffed her, and placed her in the patrol car. She was charged with resisting a law enforcement officer and misuse of 911.
Now, wait a minute. What if mama's just putting a check on the trooper? And how is that misuse? You know, sometimes you just got to be checked at the scene. Maybe you ain't doing your job the way you're supposed to be doing your jobs. You need another trooper.
Folks, again,
putting a check on you.
This is not the ideas or ideologies of Darkness Radio or True Crime Tuesday. This is simply the insane ramblings of a man who's probably on too many painkillers to know the difference. So just forgive him.
No. I'm a sound mind and body right now. I'm telling you.
An intoxicated minor was driving with a loaded AR-15 rifle in his lap Saturday evening in Florida, Tim.
Of course.
He carried the assault weapon because he's seen crazy stuff since moving to Florida from Alabama, according to the arrest affidavits. He ain't wrong, Tim. He ain't wrong. Police report that Caleb Kleiss, age 20, was involved in a traffic altercation while driving his 2016 Volkswagen near the Clearwater apartment. A witness told cops that Kleiss had the barrel of his AR-15 sticking out of the vehicle's driver's side window. At one point, Kleiss lifted the weapon off of his lap and pointed it out the window, investigators charge. This puts the witness in great fear, an affidavit states. When police located Kleiss, he was standing near his car, which was parked and running outside a laundromat. The AR-15 was displayed carelessly and laying on the dashboard in plain view of everyone walking by the store, an officer noted. The rifle was loaded with a full magazine and a round in the chamber, police say. Kleiss, pictured above in this article, was highly intoxicated. Hard to believe, Tim. And took two breath tests showing his blood alcohol content was above the 0.08 limit. After being read his rights, Kleiss reportedly told police that he carried the AR-15 for self-defense because he's seen some crazy shit since moving to Florida. The affidavits do not indicate when Kleiss relocated to Florida from a town in southeastern Alabama. Kleiss said the AR-15 had initially been in the car's backseat, but he turned the music up loud and was feeling it and moved the rifle to his lap. The 6'4", 240-pound Kleiss added that he put the rifle in his lap because he was paranoid. Kleiss was charged with drunk driving, improper exhibition of a dangerous weapon, and using a firearm under the influence. He was released early yesterday from the county jail. So, Tim, drunk driving at the age of 20, which is illegal, right, to be drinking anyway at the age of 20?
Yeah, one would think, yeah.
So, drunk driving under the age, has a loaded AR-15, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And has an loaded AR-15 while drunk. What was his bond?
I thought you were going to ask me how loud was the Skynyrd. Bond, I'm guessing. Let's go 10 grand, Dave.
That sounds still a little low to me, Tim.
Mm-hmm.
They only asked $900.
That's it?
This is the kind of kid that goes out and shoots up a Taco John's. You don't let a drunk guy with an AR-15 out on $900 bond.
Do they have Taco John's in Florida?
I'm just saying. Oh. That's what worries me.
They have a Steak and Shake. I know that.
Yeah. We have one more moving vehicle report, Tim.
Yeah?
Yeah. This one is unexpected, and there's footage. So I'm going to show this article, and the other article will be at darknessradio.com under the news tab. So you can click on it and go see the article of the football player tackling the ref. And this video, man climbs on the wing of an Alaskan airline plane departing from Las Vegas airport, then takes off his shoes and socks. Police have arrested a man who managed to climb the wing of a departing Alaska Airlines plane at Las Vegas' McCarran International Airport on Saturday. Passengers watched in shock and filmed inside Alaska Airlines Flight 1367 from Las Vegas to Portland when they saw the man climb on board the wing, sitting down and eventually taking off his shoes and socks during his estimated 45-minute stint. "What the hell did I just witness?" passenger Aaron Evans asked on Twitter, posting the video of the incident. According to a statement from Alaska Airlines obtained by USA Today, the flight was preparing for takeoff when the pilot noticed an individual advancing towards the aircraft. The pilots notified the tower. Law enforcement was dispatched and was able to eventually apprehend the individual. Police arrested Alejandro Carlson, age 41, ABC News reported, citing the Las Vegas Metropolitan Police Department. The suspect moved about the wing for nearly 45 minutes before he fell to the tarmac.
Ow.
Passengers, Evans told ABC, calling the incident definitely one of the strangest things I've ever seen in my life. Video shows the man walking to the very edge of the wing, taking off his shoes and socks for traction, sliding off the wing and falling roughly to the tarmac. He was apprehended immediately by police, the video shows. Our guests and employees are safe and we are working with law enforcement. The plane returned to the gate for a full inspection. Alaska Airlines said in a statement the man was treated for minor injuries at the University Medical Center and booked into the Clark County Jail for trespassing and disregard for public safety. Police told ABC News the investigation is ongoing. Just climbs out on the wing of a plane.
Probably should have kept his shoes on.
Holy shnikes. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Crazy. An Adelaide man who was arrested after leaving more than 7 kilograms of drugs at a hotel front counter for staff to look after received a suspended sentence because of the exceptional circumstances around the case. Khan Pasaris, 31, pled guilty in Adelaide's district court to trafficking a large commercial quantity of controlled drug and was sentenced on Friday. The court was told that Prassis left a sports bag with 7.68 kilograms of the drug Fantasy in it at the front counter of the Findon Hotel on May 14th. He asked the staff to look after it while he found the money for the booking. Judge Paul Cuthbertson said the employee and the hotel's assistant manager could see it contained a white plastic container with a viscous-like liquid drug in it. Saris returned at 9 p.m. to book in, but refused to give his credit card and details, and the staff ended up calling police. While the maximum penalty for this charge is $1 million and imprisonment for life, Judge Cuthbertson said it was possible to hand out a suspended sentence for the crime in exceptional circumstances. He described the offending as unusual in the extreme and just plain stupid behavior. Is this guy going to turn out to be the nephew of the judge? Although the quantity of the drug is such that it comes within the offense of trafficking in a large commercial quantity, the circumstances of the offending are unusual in that it is far from suggesting a highly professional, serious, and organized crime offense, Judge Cuthbertson said. It bears all the appearances of being extremely amateur and committed under circumstances suggesting the offender may well have been under the influence of some drugs at the time due to the certain risk he was running on putting drugs into the custody of the hotel and thus risking a serious criminal charge. He also said Parassus had put in effort in rehabilitation and had success with it. He also had strong family support. The judge said Parassus turned to the offending after becoming involved with an inappropriate group of acquaintances, after having to quit his job at his father's concreting business after developing an allergy to concrete, considering a 20% discount for pleading guilty and the 5 months he had already spent in custody. Judge Cuthbertson fixed a non-parole period for 2 years. He suspended the sentence in exchange for how much bond, Tim?
Oh, it sounds like he's going easy on this kid.
Now, mind you, the maximum penalty for the charge is a fine of $1 million and imprisonment for life. What was his bond?
Oh, but he's saying it could be a mistake, Dave. So I'm thinking probably $1,000.
$100. Along with strict conditions, drug testing, and 200 hours of community service. What the hell? Well, listen, obviously he had a lot of trafficking drugs, but I don't think he made that choice in the right set of mind. So I'm not going to. What?
Yeah. Yeah. You
what?
Know.
Wait, what?
Some kids make mistakes, Dave. Some, what? I mean, you know, the kid who accidentally brushed up against the ref down in Texas is probably going to get life in prison.
Accidentally
but the,
brushed up.
But the, you know, the kid who's toting a sports bag full of fantasy, he's, you know, $100 and he's out.
Mall Santa has exposed himself to a co-worker.
Oh, how lucky they are.
A mall Santa is facing felony charges after allegedly exposing himself to a teenage co-worker. According to cops, Prince Carter, age 45, was on a break from his Santa duties Monday evening at the Connecticut Post Mall when he hugged and grabbed the female victim in the break room, where Carter also allegedly exposed his jingle balls to the juvenile. Responding to a 911 call about a possible sexual assault, and I'm not laughing at that part. Milford Police Department officers subsequently arrested Carter on a risk of injury to minor and sexual assault charges. Carter was booked into the county jail. So Santa, Mall Santa, shows his mistletoe and holly.
Mm-hmm.
How long, or what is his bail set at?
Oh, to a minor. Well, I generally swing wild on these, and I'm way out of the park. So I'm going to go easy. I'll say $200.
$25,000 bond.
What?
Right. That's my point. I mean, I don't want anybody out showing their dingling. It should cost them if they're going to be an idiot like that, especially when they're showing it to minors.
Well, yeah.
But it seems some of these other crimes, you know, the guy was trafficking drugs. Large, copious amounts of drugs. But yeah, he made it under a bad decision. Maybe Santa did it under a bad decision. I don't know. Carter has been barred from returning to the mall, hard to believe, which is Connecticut's largest. Carter lives 13 miles from the mall in Bridgeport, a city about 20 miles from New Haven. In late November, the Connecticut Post Mall unveiled its Elf on a Shelf Santa's Magical Photo Adventure Set, which is keeping you safe and delightfully distanced with a contactless Santa visit. Which is good, because if this dirty pervert was allowing kids to sit on his lap, I'd have had to bury him under some presents, if you know what I mean, Tim.
Note to self, make sure junk is tucked in very tight.
Right. Masshole, age 59, battered a disabled victim during an argument over Boston sports teams.
Ah.
In a classic masshole manner, that's this article saying it, not me. A Massachusetts native, now living in Florida. Oh, what a surprise. He moved to Florida. Was arrested Saturday evening for allegedly battering a partially disabled victim who disagreed with the defendant about liking teams from Boston. Police charged that Jeffrey Randall, 59, engaged the victim in an argument about sports teams from Boston while the men were inside Randall's St. Petersburg residence Saturday evening. When the victim disagreed with Randall about liking teams from Boston, Randall became physically aggressive and pushed the victim twice in the chest, according to an arrest affidavit. The victim is partially disabled and unable to defend himself, a sheriff's deputy reported. Randall, arrested on a misdemeanor battery charge, was released from the county jail yesterday morning on his own recognizance. So this guy attacks a guy in a wheelchair who is physically unable to defend himself. And his rap sheet includes convictions for theft, trespassing, disorderly intoxication, probation violation, and battery of a law enforcement officer. He's released on his own recognizance. Have we entered bizarro world?
It's your asshole sports fan from Boston. I just think of that commercial, you know.
God, yeah. It's crazy. Well, that's it this week, folks. Thank you very much for tuning into the show and being a part of our program. We'll be back next week with more True Crime Tuesday. Remember to keep listening Wednesdays and Thursdays for the best in paranormal talk radio. That is Darkness Radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. You've been listening to True Crime Tuesday.